I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one is part of a prolific book week at Watson with director David Kennedy and his memoir of his own innocence abroad as a human rights lawyer in Uruguay in 1984. In truth, I've never read an introspection quite like this one. It reads like one man's extended notes for a screenplay of a key life moment. We all think this way, but most of us don't write it out. Who would play me in my movie at age, say, 17 or 26? What am I doing in this picture? What are the camera angles and points of view here? What did I say? Why did I say it? What did she hear? What's going on below the surface between lawyer and prisoner, between lawyer and judge? The public point of the book is to rethink the intervention of well-intentioned strangers in faraway prisons, and also to wonder out loud what became of the human rights ideals of the 70s and 80s, Carter time, into Reagan time. Even more squeamishly, we ask these questions after Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, after Gaza, and into the future. David Kennedy is the Vice President of Brown University for International Affairs, so his views count. On campuses like this one, where international relations is the most popular major, do human rights still stand for a cause or a career? David, you made the legal case 25 years ago that freed five prisoners, mostly medical students, in Uruguay under a military dictatorship, and still you came away from that adventure with doubts of all kinds. They're still with you 25 years later. Would you retell that story in short of Anna and the other prisoners in Montevideo?
Sure. I was part of a small human rights delegation in what were in many ways the salad days of the human rights movement, in which was very much an amateur kind of endeavor. We were a doctor, a writer, and myself, a young lawyer, and we went to Uruguay near the end of the military dictatorship there to visit two different prisons and see and interview a number of prisoners who had one or another health difficulty or had been identified by health institutions in the United States as being of particular concern. We were there a little over a week doing that. And I think the point of the book is to look at that experience as it seemed to me then and as it seems to me now. And I'm a lot older now, and I've thought a lot more about it in the intervening years. But some aspects of my early reaction to that experience still stand out. So first, how confusing it was, how difficult it was to understand what right I had to be there doing that when I'd never been in Uruguay before, didn't speak the language really. How could I be most effective? How could I manage my own moral outrage? How do we evaluate that kind of a short intervention? Those were questions that were with me then. If we then look back on what happened in the meantime, the human rights movement became a much more professionalized and institutionalized endeavor, and it has done a great deal of good over the ensuing years. But my sense is in the last few years, after precisely, as you say, Iraq and Abu Ghraib and so forth, many of the worries that were with us at the beginning have come back into prominence. What can go wrong when well-meaning people try to do things in faraway places? And in some sense, the human rights movement has become chastened by those experiences. I think I'm not the only one who's participated in international humanitarian ventures and then come away to write up doubts, hesitations of one sort or another.
But, you know, it seems to me overly self-conscious in the sense that you voice all those mixed feelings and doubts about a lawyer's principles in a strange jurisdiction and all that sort of thing. But the contrast immediately for me as a reader is with our military interventions. I mean, you express more doubt about, fighting a good case against torture than those bedeviled torturers thought about the 266 waterboardings. I mean, there's a certain disproportion here, it seems to me.
Me think he thinks too much, something like that. I think there may be something to that. I've been struck over the years with students at the very The very large doubts people have about doing humanitarian things abroad. Geez, should we intervene? It's their culture and so forth.
Yeah, exactly.
And then if you start talking about economic development, well, actually, we really want development, and so we can do this and we can do that and we can do that. So there definitely are fields of endeavor where we worry more about the impact of what we do in other places. I guess I would differ a little bit in your evaluation of the military, having spent some time with the military and talked to them a great deal about the way in which they operationalize the law of war in combat. There's a great deal of soul-searching and agonizing and norm-applying and so on and so forth that goes into that. And in many ways, oddly, it's not that different from humanitarian work.
But before the guy in Tampa or wherever pulls the trigger on the drone, how much back and forth thinking about my relationship to that family, that suspect, that village, is really enacted as you do it in the book?
Well, that wasn't an experience that I've ever had, so I think it's very hard for me to report on it. But I guess my own objective has not been to lower the standard of reflection in governance, but rather to raise it. So it seems to me that when people are exercising power in faraway places, and the human rights movement and humanitarian efforts have become increasingly powerful, we'd all be better off if people paused for a bit more reflection. Now, if I, as a whatever I was, 28-year-old lawyer, reflected a bit too much, maybe that goes with the terrain. But I think the effort to try to identify the dark sides of well-meaning efforts, to try to make a list of the ways in which they can go wrong, can cause more harm than good, will, I hope, eventually make those efforts more effective in the long run.
Well, let's talk about it. There was a wonderful moment after you've you've become acquainted with Anna, a medical student in prison, and then friends, where you write that at the closest connection with these people, you began to feel a fundamental estrangement. What's that all about?
Well, I think we had gone into the prison and we had met with her. In fact, the doctor who was on our team performed a physical examination to see how she was doing. So it was a very intimate and private moment. These prisoners hadn't seen folks from the outside other than a Red Cross team quite some time before. And it felt very intimate in many ways. But there was just no avoiding the fact that she was a young Uruguayan prisoner who had been tortured in a variety of ways, and I was a North American lawyer who was on my way out. So there is a sense in which the closer you come, the further you are in this kind of work that's very hard to keep track of.
Was there a better way to do it? And do Human Rights Watch, you know, the Open Society folk, people like that do it any better today, or is there a way through those barriers?
Sure. I mean, I think we've learned a lot over the 20 years about how to deal with folks who are collaborating and participating in the effort in a variety of different places, how to be more sensitive as folks from the first world in the third. I think there are ways of allowing the agenda to be driven much more directly by the political projects of the people who were there. I mean, we tended to go and see these folks only as victims. And in some way, they certainly were. But they were also agents. They were very conscious of their own political role. They had political strategies. They had risked imprisonment and they had risked torture and found themselves in prison and tortured. But they were not low on self-esteem and a plan for the future of their own lives and of their country. It was dramatic to see that, and I think that all of us in the human rights movement have learned in the ensuing years how to take that into account and build that into our thinking earlier on.
It was striking in your conversations with one of the men prisoners. You felt that he was extraordinarily chipper. He'd taken tough torture, but he was aware that this was the price in a certain way, and he wasn't down about it. I mean, actually, of course he was down about it, but he wasn't begging for your help or ours or anybody else's.
You know, you meet somebody in a prison for half an hour or an hour, or 10 minutes. It's, if you were being interviewed in a prison for 10 minutes, you would be also doing something that was unusual for you. And so they were also presenting themselves, telling a story about themselves, mm-hmm. adopting an attitude in relationship to a foreign delegation. One of the things that was most striking to me in telling the story again in the book is how much of it is about storytelling. So how much of our going down there was telling a story about what human right. rights are and what countries need to do, how much of their presentation was telling a story about who they were and what had happened to them, how much we needed them to tell a particular kind of story, how much they wanted to both tell that story and tell something else, and so on. So the overlapping storytelling of an operation like this leaves me with very little in the way of confidence that one could figure out what was really going on. Mm-hmm. What were they really thinking? Were they really chipper? I would say I'd hold back from that.
So what is the implied suggestion of alternatives to human rights interventions? I mean, you don't spell them out, but I wondered, would David say, no, go to the Peace Corps, no, stay at home and learn Latin poetry, or... or study the culture. The other alternative that seems interesting, but you don't spell it out, would be no, work on your own government, because the government of Uruguay is basically taking its cues not off the do-gooders, but off the United States government and its menu of pressures. What do you suggest as an alternative to this very gung-ho... junketeering, you call it at some point.
Well, I don't suggest that we stop doing that. So my suggestion is not that this is a bad thing to do. Actually, I was quite proud to have done it and wrote a whole book about it. I think that the point is to, at least as I see it, is to try to understand that the effort to exercise power in international situations is a more complicated and contradictory one, and one that, which one needs to be more sensitive about, whether one is trying to do it through one's own government or by visiting a foreign prison or whatever. So my purpose here is to advocate for a state of responsibility and a state of mind and a state of awareness about it, not to say that the privileged site ought to be the Cambridge City Council or the Providence City Hall or the prison in Uruguay. I don't think you can get this right by choosing your site and choosing your instrument. You can do a better or worse job. But I'm in favor of people being politically active, understanding that what they're doing is a political project, using their professional tools in their professional roles, but thinking about it in a way that's open to the plasticity rather than the ethical earnestness of the situation.
This book is for sure a catalog of ways to think about what you're doing out there, the rights of spring. Let me just ask one more general question, and then I'd love to hear from this audience. Speak to students on campus, Brown and other elsewhere, who put it on so many of their resumes nowadays that they have been activists abroad, not just students and much less tourists. It's half expected that as undergraduates, college kids will start their own NGO to end hunger or disease in Africa or some other part of the world. What are you saying to those kids who charge out of here with huge ambitions and great expectations in some fashion for themselves or the world?
Well, the first thing would be not to say anything to them, but just to applaud. I think it's terrific that students come with that kind of energy and optimism about the world and see their education as tooling up for being able to make a difference in whatever community they feel they're most drawn to, whether that's here or someplace else in the world. So I think it's a fantastic aspect of student culture today. That people. Now, that said, I think As all of our students well know, you can't solve the water problems of Laos on a weekend or over spring break.
You sure?
This is the kind of thing you have to prepare for.
It might take a whole summer.
This is the kind of thing you have to prepare for. It's going to take some time. You have to engage in a way that can be a lifelong ambition. So I see the projects that students are engaged in, which are often marvelous, of going off primarily as learning opportunities for them, setting their own agenda, figuring out what works and what doesn't. And from that point of view, I'd hope that for students who took a look at the book, they would be helped in reflecting on their own experience to see how they could learn more from the materials that they had. Now, that said, there is something very odd about the contemporary atmosphere among many students who want to make a difference in the world, that they're basically single players, working on their own. If they need an institution, they'll invent one, and so forth. A very entrepreneurial attitude, in many ways, ennobled focus on the local and the specific places in which they're acting. I would just encourage folks to notice that there are a lot of institutions that have already been built, private institutions, public institutions, the United Nations system, the governments of the world, the governments of the 50 states here, who are also very active. Being engaged politically in the world is not always a matter of a single person or a couple of people going off to try to tackle a problem on their own someplace. There are structures, there's a history, there are institutions in place. Learning what they do and how to make them more effective is also a worthy project.
There are a lot of interested folk here, interested in the book, but the issue, the world, and I'd be thrilled to have anybody come to the mic and ask a question. Tell us roughly who you are and have at us.
I'm roughly Newell Stoltz.
Great.
I have an office on the third floor. This is set in 1984, you say? About that time, my wife and I were living in South Africa, which at that point was close to being a police state. And I recall from those days, there were many Americans, some students who were drawn by that situation to try to do good works in South Africa. And sometimes local South Africans were very apprehensive that even well-meaning but inexperienced young people coming into a police state situation could implicate innocently but really good people in South Africa who were trying to do similar work. And there was a lot of worry that Americans came in with their money and their enthusiasm and their return ticket 3 weeks later, and while they were there, they would somehow screw things up for people who couldn't leave and were on the ground. Have you ever sensed that kind of problem?
Definitely. I think that was, in many ways, it was a realization that South Africa was very often cited as the case that led to the desirability or the perceived desirability of having a more institutionalized and steady presence and engagement rather than this in and out for people who are interested in bringing about change in faraway places. But I think we've learned a lot over the ensuing years about the range of problems of that type, the ways in which an internationally oriented human rights movement can crowd out other kinds of local initiatives. That can happen in many fields. It can happen in the public health arena, in which well-financed international AIDS efforts can pull resources away, including human resources away from the national healthcare system. There are lots of ways in which well-meant interventions can do harm and sometimes do more harm than good. I think sometimes social justice has been defined too narrowly by the human rights movement in ways that would be unrecognizable to people in a given situation who would have their own objectives for emancipation. And we know social justice is the kind of thing that has to get defined each time in each place by people struggling all over again. So I think Professor Stoltz puts his finger on the kind of problem that was acknowledged in 1984, an interesting year now, thinking about saying the words 1984, And that we've been trying to react to in the larger international humanitarian movement ever since.
Hi, I'm Alana Shever. I'm a fellow here at the Watson Institute. And I wanted to follow up on your comment about students feeling the need to go solo as they do these projects. And I was wondering how much it was that they weren't recognizing the institutions that existed that were trying to do that work, and how much it was that part of their education here at Brown it has been about criticizing those institutions, and if that potentially was one of the motives that made students feel like they wanted to found a new organization when they were looking to do social justice work elsewhere in the world.
I mean, there are a lot of students here, so we should get some personal testimony about whether. But that certainly is something that I've seen. That seems right to me. There's a general, and has been for 10 or 15 years among students that I've taught, a general disillusionment with the large international organizations and with government efforts and so forth. Maybe that's changing now. Maybe the idea of public service is a different one.
Spell that out, David. What are the disappointments? What is Human Rights Watch not doing right?
Well, I was thinking actually of the UN organizations more than Human Rights Watch, although they have become a very large and powerful organization too. They take up several floors in the Empire State Building, and they but I think
that's the moral height that you
that's the moral height. Yes, they're definitely naming and shaming from on high. I think that it would be, I mean, criticizing the work of these institutions is a very specific thing. So each one has its own difficulties. So if we look at institutions like Human Rights Watch, the routinization and institutionalization of naming and shaming has some real strengths. It can mobilize public opinion in a variety of ways, but it also has a tendency to define the problem in ways that are catchy and to try to define the relationship to local contexts in which human rights violations are taking place in a particular way. So there's a routinization of the nature of evil in the world and our response to it that could be made more complicated by initiatives that individuals might undertake in a variety of ways. Difficulties with intergovernmental organizations are altogether different. So the frustration with working through the UN system, which is part of the diplomatic order and is overwhelmingly male in many ways, confines itself to only particular kinds of problems, is always on a short leash to a few major states and so on, or is harnessed to donor nations and government. Those are frustrations that for a different group of students will seem problematic and make them not seem institutions they want to spend time in. I think we've done too little to try to understand the limitations of being a solo player. So I think we just want to put acting more or less on your own and starting an NGO or working with a small local NGO as another in a series of institutionalized mechanisms for being part of an emancipatory project that can have its dark sides and its advantages.
Okay. Professor Gleason.
Tom Gleason, retired professor of something or other. It seems to me that this really is about one of the major sort of problems of 20th century foreign policy, especially in the form of literary engagements with it. I mean, I think automatically of The Third Man. I think of Graham Greene, The Ugly American. The American who brings his particular naive, blundering, uninformed, polarizing attitudes into a complex situation and screws it all up and somebody dies and then he goes home again and the situation is roiled and sad and Graham Greene writes a book about it. But it seems to me now we're to some extent in a different kind of world where America is now sort of enclosed and Rupert Murdoch controls so much of what we know and find out here, and there are things that can't be investigated that we all know about without enormous outcry from organized lobbies. And newspapers, the Los Angeles Times has gone. I have a friend who didn't take a job on the New York Times because he doesn't think it's going to be in existence in 2 years. It seems to me in this peculiar way we're more and more isolated. So when I see Brown students going out and spending the summer in Sierra Leone trying to find out whether the constitutional court there is working, I don't think of Graham. I don't think of the third man, somebody going to Vienna who doesn't know what Harry Lime is really up to. I think, and I don't think of people who are on solo crusades. I think of people who are trying to educate themselves and who are willing to take quite a few risks. And in my experience, go out with quite open minds. And so I really think that what students have done here over the last decade in particular by way of exploring and trying to take a stand, the good that it does and the importance to their education far outweighs whatever parochial stuff comes of it and whatever mistakes are made.
Well said. Is there a question there?
I guess I'd ask David how he feels about this. He may have made it clear already, but maybe he'd write a little gloss over the top on it.
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think that it's the educational advantages for people here, and particularly young people, in getting out in the world and being active and engaged in a wide variety of ways and in a wide variety of projects, partly as training for making a difference and for being politically active and politically alive in life, are terrific. But I think we really need to see it that way. This is training in being a politically aware, alive, and responsible person. Now, how does one do that well? What does it take to prepare to do that well? It's very different than thinking, what does it take to prepare me to go and fix the, you know, water problems of the Middle East? That, too, one needs to know something about that. But if we see that the advantages are those that I think Professor Gleason put his finger on, namely opening up the consciousness of an entire generation to the nature of the world and its differences and its difficulties, that's going to require a different kind of preparation, including critical reflective preparation, as well as knowledge of where you're going and so forth and what you're trying to accomplish and how to do it. And that some people we're enlisting the help of hundreds and hundreds of people around the world in educating our students by collaborating with them in these projects while they go out there and trying to protect them from harm and try to make sure they don't do anything that's harmful. So, and I think we can rely on the kindness of strangers in that way, and we can rely on the wisdom of our students to avoid the kind of ugly American situation. I should also say, not all of our students are Americans. There are very many people here who are from all over the world and are going all over the world, and there are many people who are going to the United States to try to do this kind of thing. And we need to constantly remember the United States is a country, too, which has its problems and its water difficulties and its prisons, and also could benefit from a little scrutiny and critical reflection.
Hi, Nisha Shah, also visiting at the Watson Institute. And I had a question, or maybe I want to ask you to reflect a little bit more on your crisis of faith, if we can put it in those terms. And I want to know, was the crisis the idea that what was well-intentioned was not well-intentioned? So is it the definition of good that you need to call into question, or it's the way in which you go to pursue it?
Well, I think for me it was an element of both. I mean, it seems – I think about it in slightly different terms. I'd say there are kind of two voices in international humanitarianism. One is the voice of ethical, universal self-confidence in which you denounce in the name of a higher virtue something that's happening somewhere else, and you feel quite separated from it. And the more I worked in that frame – the less compelling the moral self-confidence of the definition, the sense of separation from the problem, and so forth became. On the other hand, the antidote is get really pragmatic, enter into some kind of a more engaged relationship, drop the ethical universalism, and try to solve problems in a real. And the more I work in that vein, the more I ran into the difficulties of unanticipated consequences and so forth. And I ended up thinking that these are problems of an active life. They're not things that can be solved with the right recipe. And so what one needs to do is understand them. The antidote to one is the other, but they both have problems. And so in that sense, I would describe it less as a crisis of faith than as an awareness of a set of entangled difficulties with a project that I still think is a very important one.
Before the next question, can I just throw in the fact that thinking about what American students can do abroad, David, I'm just recalling three medical students that I met in Havana last December, and it seemed to me I'll never forget that model of students going to another place to learn doctoring in Havana with 100 or 200 perhaps American students doing very much the same kind of thing, getting a free education, but also in some ways a very happy indoctrination in an alternative system of medicine. But they had been there by the time I met them for 5 years or so, completely acculturated, mastering the subtleties of Cuban Spanish social situations. And I thought, now that's another way. That's not a visit. It's not. There's nothing remotely moralistic or bringing universal values. It's kind of at least bringing a great deal of, as it happened, African-American female energy to a Cuban 50-year history of aggressive international medicine. An extraordinarily powerful combination, but it seemed to avoid all of the downsides, all the dark sides of these experiences we're talking about.
Well, first of all, Brown is filled with people from other countries who've decided to do that here, to try to spend some time coming to feel comfortable in our own odd, weird culture, and to try to pick up on the vibe of how to be active and successful and what there is that can be learned here in one way or the other. And so the idea of going native or total immersion is one not just that Americans do abroad, but that a lot of people do in the United States. In my experience, that has its advantages and its opportunities, but it also has its limits. So it seems to me very often in political activity, the advantage of the sudden shock of an alternative point of view can be very helpful, both for the person who has it and for the people who are on the ground. When somebody comes to the United States from somewhere else, and we've had here at Brown people who've come from very different places with very different political perspectives, and they say things, and we only see them for an hour, we only see them for an afternoon. Well, sometimes we think about things we wouldn't have otherwise thought about. So I don't discount the idea that one can be politically engaged short-term in very different places and long-term very much at a place one feels at home. Both are modes of engaging the world. If you found one that has no dark sides, you should bottle it.
Hi, Karen Lynch from the Watson Institute. In terms of the human rights movement, you gave a talk, a keynote speech on the anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. And you, if I recall it correctly, you were very critical of the limitations of the human rights movement, if one considers human rights more broadly in terms of human right to health, human right to a livelihood. Where would you see the human rights movement evolving? Where should it go at this point?
Good question. I mean, I think as somebody who's followed with deep interest the development of a very powerful and institutionalized, professionalized human rights movement in the years since I took this trip to Uruguay, I've been struck with their success. So you can now, there's a profession. You can become a professional human rights activists in a variety of different ways. They're very well-funded institutions. And the both methods of human rights enforcement and the particular definition of rights themselves have become ever more refined. And so if we look back on the Declaration of Human Rights now, so many years later, we could say there's been a great deal of success. My own feeling, though, is that the heyday of human rights is past. As the dominant or leading vocabulary for speaking about international social justice issues, that it rose most in the most pronounced way in the period of globalization and neoliberal economic expansion. It was fueled by many well-intentioned people building these institutions and defining social justice in this particular way. But it would be surprising if a series of definitions written down by Eleanor Roosevelt 50 years ago would survive as the definition of social justice 100 years after she participated in writing. It would be very surprising. So I think you could say just time moves on. But it's also true that we've become more aware of the difficulties, the ways in which well-meaning ventures can ignore their costs, can enchant the tools that they use, can define justice as only things individuals have, not background social conditions, can focus too much on how individuals relate to the state and not how much they relate to one another, can see that everybody has rights, but that makes solutions that involve sharing and compromise sometimes difficult to achieve. There's a tip of the iceberg's problem in which human rights can define some things as absolutely off the table while leaving many other things unremarked, and so on. So those are the kinds of things I think have come much more into the consciousness of everyone involved in international human rights as they become more institutionalized. And I hope that we would see in the next 10 years a proliferation of many more diverse models of pursuing social justice and defining social justice made in many more different places than human rights.
Nina Tannenwald, Watson Institute. I wanted to follow up on one of your responses to Karen's question. What is the evidence that human rights has passed its heyday? And it seems to me, I think many of your points that you're making are very important in terms of the unintended consequences of good intentions. But that seems quite a different point from the claim that human rights, as an empirical matter, has passed its heyday. And the evidence, to me, when I look at it, I don't see evidence for that kind of claim. You look at, for example, what's happening in the regions. I mean, the African states have basically, in the last decade, reorganized and created a vastly much stronger human rights regime. Even the ASEAN states, where human rights have normally been quite weak, are even talking about creating some kind of regional human rights regime there. So you know, the empirical evidence out there doesn't necessarily point in that direction. So I'm wondering what evidence you would point to support that claim, or is it really more of a normative prescriptive argument?
So thanks. It's my own sense of where we're at. But I would say why I feel that way is, first of all, I think 100 years from now, there will still be institutions promoting human rights and government declarations and so forth, assuming the seas don't rise too far. So I don't see human rights going away anytime soon. I see it being, for people who are investing in it as a career strategy, I think it will continue to be a viable career strategy. But I think the things that have struck me, that give me the feeling that a historical turning point is around us now, would be the following things. The proliferation of a variety of other diverse modes of pursuing social justice by people who in 10 years ago or 15 years ago might have focused on human rights more exclusively, development kinds of things, social things of a variety of kinds, religious movements and religious vocabularies for speaking about social justice, particularly in the third world. The second would be the number of disillusioned humanitarians who are out there speaking about what, so David Reif and many others who've had experiences with Médecins Sans Frontières or other organizations and have thought it's actually valuable to start putting the difficulties and dark sides and doubts into public debate. Another would be the feeling of overreaching. So I think if you look at Africa, for example, the reactions to the indictment by the International Criminal Court of the President of Sudan have been quite striking. I did not expect the very broad political pushback against that indictment. Now, there may be many ways of explaining that particular situation, but it has to do with a feeling that's out there among many countries that they can say no to international institutional efforts. Why do they feel that way? And I think the last thing I'd say is the number of times that human rights have gotten mixed up with interventionist military campaigns of one sort or another. So if you are bombing for human rights, that is going to have an impact on many other things people are going to be doing for human rights. And it's going to be an impact that will not be all to the credit of the human rights movement. So I look at those things and I say, something's going on here. We're beginning to see a turning point in which the exclusive and very virtuous image that human rights had, particularly in the first world, is being increasingly drawn into debate.
Just a very quick follow-up. I think I agree with Nina on this point. And it seems to me that maybe it's not a turning point. Maybe it's a more complicated figure than a turning point.
A rut in the road, or?
Well, maybe I don't want to bring roads in just at this point. but it seems to me that we have to maintain some kind of sense, which is a universalist post-Enlightenment sense, which runs athwart all sorts of intellectual movements today, that there are some things you just can't do to people. It seems to me if we retreat into situations of great cultural complexity where everything has to be negotiated out and universal values are despised as oversimplifications and destructive, we're going to lose something very vital about international affairs and about just the sense that there are some very simple categories of civilization and barbarity. And if we're too culturally sophisticated, we'll miss those. And I guess that causes me some concern, even when I hear you mentioning what you think might be a turning point.
So I've never been in favor of cultural complexity. That's not the argument. That's not the argument. I think the argument is that we have other ways, we as a human species have other ways of thinking about moral responsibility, ethics, and political justice than the clash between universal ethics and particular resistance. And that frame has run its course. So it's useful, it's helpful, but I don't think it's the only way. So it seems to me, I would like to feel that when I speak to somebody about what I think one simply can't do to somebody else, I can do that speaking as a moral agent, as a political agent, as a person of faith, as a lot of things, but not as the voice of the universal ethical. Because that's run us into a variety of different kinds of quandaries before. So it'll not go away. People are going to continue doing that. But that's not, it seems to me, the only lesson of the Enlightenment that we could learn. I think there are a variety of different strands of religious expressions for social justice, ranging from the Catholic social justice tradition through to a variety of different approaches that are active in places around the world, including here in our own country, that speak about ethical responsibility in ways in which the actor is not duty-bound to the universal, but is a free agent. So a free agent who's responsible in some way. I think that idea of free agency is not incompatible with ethics is a very different way of speaking than the agent is the particular and the universal is the discipline. I think we have to get away from that.
David, could I ask once more about Afghanistan? Not
sure.
Least because Brown's own, Watson's own, Richard Holbrook, has been deputized by the President of the United States to cobble together a complex solution, if there is such a thing, to that whole regional mess. And because the United States is still on the verge of an extended military intervention in Afghanistan, I'm really wondering what it would take to distribute your book as a sort of the ultimate counterinsurgency manual, to apply the sensitivity, the doubt, the caution, the questions about all these relationships to the military side of life. Again, I'm just struck that there's so much more consideration given to the subtleties, the nuances of human relationships on the civilian side than on the military. What would it take to make these the rules of military engagement?
Well, I think first, what would it take to make human rights and the law of war the rules of military engagement?
I don't mean that so much as the self-awareness, the awareness of dark sides, the awareness of cost, the awareness of mystery in all these human relationships.
Well, that'd be great. So I think one of the things that's come, if we think of the torture memos, for example, that have just come out very recently, one of the things that's very interesting is the role of law in, which begins with the idea that we're bringing a human rights kind of or law of war kind of perspective to bear. Everything has to be proportional. You have to be very careful in making sure you know what you're targeting and not make distinguish civilians and combatants and so forth. So it starts off with good intentions, and it ends up being a vernacular that becomes professionalized and institutionalized, and sometimes that's wonderful. But it can also lead to a situation where everybody thinks they're right and nobody thinks they're responsible. So everybody thinks what they did was proportional and what the enemy did was completely unproportional, and therefore their side is just and the other side's not. And what started out as a practical way of thinking becomes a way of making everybody not reflect on the. Or in the torture memo case, who's responsible? So you could say, well, the people who did it weren't responsible because the law said they could do it, and the politicians weren't responsible because the law said they could do it, and the lawyers weren't really responsible either because they were interpreting the law within the reasonable professional canons. And so something has happened of a political nature which is very difficult to locate moral responsibility for on any actual human agent. I think that's a problem. So part of the argument of this book and of a parallel book I wrote about the law of war is to try to awaken within the military command, but also within soldiers on the field, a sense of their own moral agency. And I'll just give one more anecdote, which is there are all these stories of soldiers in Iraq who came back from the field quite troubled that they had killed civilians or children or whatever, and then they're counseled back to duty and back to mental health by their mental health professionals, by their pastors, by their military commanders, who say, well, what you did was proportional and so on and so forth. So that in one or another way, the norms, the distinctions, are used to quiet the sense, the very normal human sense of ethical jeopardy that goes with violence. In this book, I'm talking about the ethical jeopardy that goes with political action, which I don't think is any more or less dramatic than the ethical jeopardy that goes with military affairs. But I think the mechanisms by which it's shrouded and elided and denied are quite similar. And yeah. In that sense, it would be interesting to explore in a parallel way how that happens for folks in the military.
David, you've given us a provocative book, this Rights of Spring, and a fascinating conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.